History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there right where you live that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our more seasoned neighbors, and more importantly, to patiently listen to those memories as they bubble back to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we become inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The month of February always flies by too quickly, doesn't it? But February is Black History Month, and before that calendar turns to March, I want to make sure we take some time to reflect on the contributions of the close to a million African American men and women who served in our armed forces during World War II. I guess I should say our segregated armed forces in World War II, so many of them seeing their service as a quest for the double V, victory over America's enemies abroad, yes, but also victory over discrimination right here in the United States. We've heard from some remarkable African American veterans on Hometown Heroes over the years, and while we don't have time to revisit all of them today, we are going to hear some examples of some of the things they did and also some of the things they had to overcome. But we're also going to hear an emphasis on unity, not to be confused with uniformity, but the idea that when we focus on the things we share in common as Americans, particularly in terms of the ideals of America, the less we're confused, distracted, or impeded by the things some would suggest should separate or divide us as Americans. And before we hear some of those World War II veterans who haven't just talked about unity but have demonstrated it with their actions, I want you to hear about the Brigadier General Charles E. McGee Unity Award, established this month by the nonprofit organization called the Friends of the National World War II Memorial. At hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, I have the video linked for you from that organization announcing the inaugural recipient of that award, Robin Roberts, the longtime host of Good Morning America, but also the daughter of a Tuskegee Airman. Robin's production company recently produced a History Channel documentary on her father and his fellow flyers called Tuskegee Airmen: Legacy of Courage. I have that linked for you online too, but let's take a quick listen to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, congratulating not only the recipient of the award, but also its namesake, General Charles McGee, who recently celebrated his 101st birthday.
Brigadier General Charles McGee and the Tuskegee Airmen embody our greatest generation, who believed in a fundamental idea within the Constitution, that every person, regardless of their background or origin, should be judged by their merit and the content of their character. Despite the racial discrimination they face at home, they fought bravely for our country in history's most brutal war to protect this idea. Renowned as the best pilots in World War II, the Red Tails had the dangerous mission of escorting bomber aircraft into combat, losing only 27 aircraft in 1,578 combat missions over 26 months. And to Brigadier General McGee, who's watching this today, all of you should know that he flew 136 combat missions in World War II alone. And across three wars, Brigadier General McGee flew 409 combat missions in total. Congratulations, General McGee, and I'm so proud to be here today to honor you and all of these brave Americans who ushered in an era of unprecedented peace and prosperity for the entire world, blazed a path for younger American generations to follow, and expedited the official integration of the United States military in 1948. Indeed, all of you led change toward a stronger and more effective force. You fought because you believed in the Constitution and the idea that we are all born free and equal. The core idea, the ideal, the value, the very center of our country that unifies this experiment in democracy that we call the United States of America. It is fitting that this award in their honor recognizes those who exemplify the spirit of unity and devotion. Robin, as the daughter of a Tuskegee Airman, no one has a deeper appreciation of the sacrifices and dedication of these pioneers than you. So on behalf of the 2.3 million men and women who currently wear the cloth of our nation, we are grateful for your efforts. You represent all that is good in our nation today, the triumphs of a past and the boundless potential of our future. Thank you so much for all you have done for our country.
Again, that's General Mark Milley, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, congratulating Robin Roberts as the first recipient of the General Charles McGee Unity Award, sponsored by the Friends of the National World War II Memorial. If you watch that entire video online at hometownheroesradio.com, I think you'll also be touched by what Robin Roberts has to say.
Thank you so much for this honor, and it most certainly is an honor, as it bears a name of General Charles McGee. He reminds me so much of my beloved father, Colonel Lawrence E. Roberts, a fellow Tuskegee Airman. In fact, I was born in Tuskegee when my father returned years later as an ROTC instructor, when he returned later. Like my dad, General McGee, he doesn't demand respect. He commands it just by his presence, a man of such dignity and unity. General McGee truly is a gentle warrior. I have such immense appreciation for the Friends of the National World War II Memorial. Thank you for establishing this award in honor of an American hero, General McGee. And thank you for your work to provide a place where we can learn more about the achievements of the greatest generation, including the broader legacy of how their brave service helped influence generations. Yes, your mission of teaching the lessons of yesterday to unite the generations of tomorrow. General McGee is a shining inspiration for unity, an example for all of us, one I try my best to follow, and that is to use my platform to find and highlight all that unites us. What we reach for may be different, but what makes us reach is the same. Love of family, our community, our country. My mama taught me long ago that we all have more in common than not, so why not celebrate that instead of our differences? Celebrate all that unites us. Yes, unity. Thank you, and blessings to all.
The best part about those words from Robin Roberts is that I know she means them. I've had the privilege of hosting a couple of national TV broadcasts with Robin years ago, and I know that she pours her heart into everything she does. I know some people that she has taken the time to personally encourage in their battles with cancer that parallel her own journey. And really, I just know how genuine she is. So I want to add my congratulations and exhortation to continue championing that cause of unity and continuing to shine a light on the individual and collective examples that our World War II veterans have given us. If her father didn't make it home from his dangerous work in World War II, Robin would have never been born. Congrats again to Robin Roberts. Check out those videos online when you have time. And now let's hear what it was like to be a Tuskegee Airman during World War II. They, of course, faced doubt, discrimination, and eventually danger overseas. But what they proved in flying escort missions for American bombers was that they were just as skilled and courageous as pilots of any other racial or ethnic background. Bob Friend survived 142 missions in World War II, flying those red-tailed P-51 Mustangs that the 332nd Fighter Group would become famous for. They knew they were expendable as a first line of defense surrounding those bombers.
Well, we were that. There's no doubt about that. And the objective was to allow that bomber to do its mission. And certainly, yes, we were the buffer. But strangely enough, they didn't concentrate on us nearly as much as they did on trying to get the bombers down. So it was fairly easy, as a rule, to chase them off. Don't get me wrong, they would get through sometime because they'd get above and start a dive and just dive straight through. It's almost like suicide. You're going to get caught and picked up after, if not before he gets there. But they, too, had an objective, and that was protect their homeland.
And they had a variety of different planes. At the end of the war, they had planes that were faster and superior to even the one you were flying. Did you ever engage any of those ME-262s?
Yes, I met a 262, and strangely, I met him head-on. And I didn't realize we were going head-on. I thought first that I was overtaking him. The silhouette looked the same. But then when I saw the guns firing, I knew that we were coming toward each other. And we went right past, when I turned around, he was gone.
That's one of those you don't even figure out what it was till it's gone, huh?
Well, dog fights are funny. It can be going on, you know, rather heavily, and then all of a sudden there's nothing. Everybody's gone. Some people took off for home, others, and it was important for us not to go chasing after them, because if you did, you left the bombers open to secondary attacks.
I thought that was a dynamic that was well depicted in the George Lucas film, Red Tails, that aspect of, hey, you got to stick to the plan, not be going for the glory and chasing down a fighter. Was that ever a temptation of yours to go after one of those German planes?
Well, you know, it's like once you get locked on to him, you know, you don't want to let go. But we had some well-grounded discipline, and that was don't be drawn off.
Where did that come from?
The commander. Colonel Davis was a man that had a tough job. What he had to do was to take people who were relatively raw. All of us, how far much more experience could you say one had? You know, guy graduated in first class, guy graduated a month later in second class. And he, from these people, had to take people for, or identify people for key positions. Squadron commanders, group operations officers, squadron operations officers, maintenance officers, you know. And he had to get the right guy. Best of all, he recognized when he had made a mistake with a guy, and he made the change right away. He did not mess around.
That's leadership for you. With all those missions, I'm sure you had plenty of close calls. But is there one for you that when you think back on, you feel like, you know, God was really looking out for me on that one?
Yes. We had some of those. I had a barge explode, and I flew through all that debris, got through okay. And the ones that, not direct, but it happens, when on one mission, the fellow that was going to lead the mission said, "Who's flying Charlie today?" Charlie was the last position in the squadron.
Tail and Charlie.
So I said, "I'm flying Charlie." So he said, "Well, let's switch airplanes. Mine's a newer airplane, and Charlie has a lot more activity, you know, staying in formation and so forth. So you take that and I'll fly yours." He never came back. The airplane quit on him.
So that would have been you in the airplane that quit.
Yes. And other instances, when attacking a ground target, you can see the rounds coming. And actually, you can do things about it. If it looks like it's going to hit you, you're okay, because it goes like this. But if it looks like it's going by in front, be careful. You better change something, change speed, change direction, change something, because it was pretty much hanging on to you then.
I'm sure you found plenty of bullet holes in your planes, but with stuff like that, with that anti-aircraft fire coming at you, what's the closest it actually came to hitting you? You personally, I mean your body, not your plane.
I never came close to being hit. I know that there were friends who had rounds go through the cockpit. You know, one guy, the first aid kit was behind your back. Took the first aid kit out. Another one, the round died just as it got there, and it stayed stuck in his windshield. Yeah.
Close enough.
Yes.
How much did you enjoy the plane you were flying? For people that haven't experienced that airplane, what was it like for you?
That airplane, the P-51, absolutely so far ahead of its time. It really can be said that it swung the war. It swung the things in our direction without question. And as far as the pilots feel, I didn't feel like I climbed into an airplane. I felt like I put it on. I wore it.
Why do you think it's important to tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen? What's the value of that for us today in knowing what you guys did and what you went through?
Well, I think the most important aspects of it is not to let it happen again. The reason we don't need it again. I think that all you have to do is look at the relationships of the people at events like this. Much different. Much different. Some people, these people that you would probably never have had words for. What do you say? I know that the country itself has just absorbed so much in the way of the business in race relations. I feel that we should not even bother with considerations about race. I'm not saying that people should be not like their heritage. I like mine. I'm proud of my heritage. You know? But I don't think that it should be something that we say African-American, Indian-American, Mexican-American, Latin-American, German-American, Canadian-American. Who needs that? You're an American or you're not.
You're an American or you're not. And there is no doubt Lieutenant Colonel Bob Friend was most certainly an American, an exemplary one at that. He passed away in 2019 at the age of 99. But the power in the example of what he and the rest of the Tuskegee Airmen did in World War II continues to grow. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come in this special Black History Month edition of Hometown Heroes. We'll hear about a Baseball Hall of Famer's experiences in World War II, as well as the reason one veteran told us segregation, but perhaps more clearly, his refusal to tolerate it any longer may have saved his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Black History Month, focusing on the contributions of the nearly 1 million African-American men and women who served in our then-segregated armed forces during World War II. Among them were many whose names we know now because of their athletic achievements. The legendary boxer Joe Louis volunteered for the Army just a month after the attack on Pearl Harbor. If you ever visit Arlington National Cemetery, you will see Joe Louis's grave prominently featured there. Jackie Robinson, who would go on to break baseball's color barrier, had a well-documented stint in the Army during World War II, including his courageous stand against discrimination on a bus in Texas during the war. Larry Doby, the first Black player in the American League, served in the Navy in World War II, following in the footsteps of his father, who had served in World War I. But often underneath the story we have heard lies one that we may not have heard. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you may remember that one of Larry Doby's Negro League teammates, Monty Irvin, was actually offered the distinction of becoming the first African American in the majors, and the reason it did not unfold that way goes back to his Army service in World War II. Born in Alabama as one of 13 children in a family with legendary athletic talent, Monty Irvin grew up in New Jersey. And how about this? While playing college football, he actually moonlighted as a professional baseball player in the Negro Leagues, playing only road games under the pseudonym Jimmy Nelson so his double life would not be uncovered. True story. Irvin's experiences in barnstorming tours with major league stars made it clear that the players in his league could hold their own. But baseball's color barrier was still there.
Well, we were disappointed, and we made some friends with some of the major leaguers, and we told them, we said, why don't you guys talk it up? You know, maybe we could help him win a pennant or a World Series. So they said, well, we'll do what we can, but you know how negative the owners are. I said, well, keep talking, because it's bound to happen one of these days. And sure enough, in 1946, Bob Feller, one of my dear friends, he formed an all-star team, and Satchel Paige formed an all-star team, and they played each other. They broke about even, but it showed everybody, you know, including the scouts, that we could play baseball as well as anybody. All we needed was a chance. And after that, the scouts, out there looking for talent, signed a lot of the African-American players.
Now, you at one point left the Negro Leagues and went to the Mexican League, won a triple crown there. But I understand with all the great hitters that you could have looked at to model your game after, it wasn't someone in your league, but it was an Italiano wearing pinstripes that you modeled your swing after. Is that true?
That's true, Joe DiMaggio. I saw him when he broke in with the Yankees in 1936. I was hitting the ball well, but I wasn't hitting the ball a lot to right field. So I want to, you know, being a right-handed hitter, I wanted to pull the ball, so I used to go there and watch him, and he was a dead pull hitter, and how quick he was, you know, when he was getting the bat around with his follow through, and how graceful he looked at the plate and so on. So in 39, when I went to Daytona Beach for spring training, I practiced hitting the way he did. And by the time spring training was over, I had it. And from 39 on, I became a pretty good hitter, I tell you.
Yeah, 422 is pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was tough to strike out. I was strong, you know, naturally strong. And all I needed to do was just get that bat around a little quicker. And with the Joe DiMaggio stance and the fact that, you didn't stride very far, maybe 4 or 5 inches, you could judge the ball and see the ball and be in position to hit a curveball, changeup, or fastball. So it didn't take me long to copy Joe. Later on, I told him about it. He said, "Well, I'm glad somebody thought enough of me to copy my style."
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked pretty well for you, too.
And guess what? Willie Mays did the same thing.
Hey, there you go. Everyone seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Yep. Do you remember how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Standing on second base in Puerto Rico.
Really?
When they announced that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and the people started to cheer. So I said to myself, I said, they don't know, you know, what a big problem that's going to be, because everything that came into Puerto Rico came in on a ship.
Mm.
You know, the rice and the beans and everything else. And then 3 weeks, everything, rice and beans triple. The price of rice and beans triple down there. And so I definitely will remember, you know, being on second base when I heard that this disastrous thing has occurred.
Yeah, not many people can claim that they were standing on second base at the time.
Yeah.
And then Uncle Sam would get his hands on you. What did it mean to you when you were drafted and you realized that you're going to have to put baseball on hold and go serve?
I did. I had just left Mexico, you know, of the MVP down there. But I knew that, you know, you had to go. I had a daughter who was only 6 months old. I didn't want to leave her and my wife. But, you know, Uncle Sam called, saying we had to go. I was drafted, spent my training in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after about 6 weeks, went on down to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a few months, we caught the a troop ship going to England. It was in the North Atlantic for 19 days, and the North Atlantic can be rough, even in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's almost impossible. And so in 19 days, we were on that ship in a convoy of 500 ships. And guess what? We didn't lose one ship out of a convoy of 500. But when we got to Liverpool, we couldn't stand up because of that rocking and roll. Yeah, that was a funny thing.
That would do it to you. And much like baseball was segregated at the time, the military was segregated at this time. And
yeah,
so you were in
tragic.
The 1313th Engineer General Service Regiment?
Yes, uh-huh.
With all African-American soldiers?
Yeah, uh-huh. At the beginning, we had a white officer, and later on, he was replaced by an African-American CO, and then we got two or three other lieutenants. You know, we felt, you know, more comfortable, and it was treated a little better. So during... In 1944, after they invaded, June 6, 1944, was D-Day. But we didn't get there until 2 months later. And when we got there, Omaha Beach had been cleaned up. After staying around the beach for a while, we moved across Paris and settled on the other side. And then mainly our duty then became guard duty. A lot of the Nazi soldiers had surrendered, and there was a problem because there were so many of them. We had a, you know, it was a chore trying to keep them all, keep track of all of them. So that's what we mainly did until the, you know, the war was over in Japan.
Now, I did read that your unit, during the Battle of the Bulge, that your unit was assigned not necessarily on the front line, but in reserve and near Reims, France.
That's true.
In the Meuse line and ready to blow up bridges if the order came?
Yeah. We, you know, blow up bridges and doing a lot of guard duty of refineries because we knew that the Nazis, needed fuel. A whole outfit was guarding the fuel depots, and luckily they stopped them, up at the Battle of the Bulge, and they never did get to Reims. But Reims was only about 60, 70 miles away, and if they had broken through, there was going to be some heavy fighting in and around Reims, France. We were so happy that it didn't happen.
Now, I've read before, and I've interviewed several African-American veterans from World War II, told me about how they were treated overseas and then how they were treated back in the States. Did you notice a difference, and did that time overseas give you a new perspective?
Yes, it did. We were treated better by the natives, by the English and the French and then people from Belgium. We had a lot of problems with our own soldiers, mainly, and why they wanted to, be so anti, we just couldn't understand it. And then after we came back here, back to the States, we were scorned also, and we couldn't understand why. We were called on to do a job, and we did it. But seemingly nobody appreciated enough, to welcome us back home.
Well, I'm sure on cold nights in France, in a foxhole, you probably weren't thinking, I'm going to be a baseball Hall of Famer someday.
No, not at all. In fact, before it went over, I never thought that we'd ever get the chance to, play in the majors.
Mm-hmm.
But after going, seeing how things were done over there and so on, some of the guys was very happy that they experienced a lot of freedom. And when we came back, the saying was, if they can fight for the country, why can't we play for them? So there was a move afoot, to get us into Major League. I remember Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia had a group, and he was, along with Adam Clayton Powell and some other politicians, had that in their minds to do it. But then Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, so that...
Hold on there, because the way I heard it, Branch Rickey wanted to sign you.
He did, and I signed with him. I told him I'd had a hard time, didn't have a chance to play at all over there, and I said, I'll sign with you, but I'll let you know when I'm ready. He said, well, that's great.
And you had some ringing in your ears from all the artillery overseas?
Yeah, I had an inner ear problem, and 2 years, it got better. And then I, started to play like I had been playing. And selecting Jackie, they picked a college-educated person who had gained publicity and notoriety out there at the UCLA. He starred in four sports. He was wasn't the best player, but he was the most adequate person that Branch Rickey could have taken. And then, lo and behold, Jackie improved. Every year, he became a clutch hitter. He became a real good second baseman. He became very thrilling on the bases. So it shows you that, how I guess smart that Branch Rickey was by picking Jackie. And we're all grateful and very happy that he did such a great job of pioneering.
Oh, and it sounds like one of the reasons you said wait on me is you felt if you were the first one and you weren't 100% that you wouldn't have represented your whole league and whole race
True.
Of people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it worked out just the way it should have.
Worked out just fine. Jackie did a great job. He passed away in 1972. Can't believe that he's been gone that long. But he did one super job. Had to take a lot. But he did. And we're, again, very grateful. Well, it's a wonderful job that he did.
And did I interpret correctly when you talked about that, that you and other African-American veterans of the war who came back felt like what you did overseas and what you proved in doing so had a big role in your access eventually to Major League Baseball?
Yeah. I think what we did helped the cause, and again, I think it's made it a little easier. They realized if given a chance, we could do it just as good as anybody else.
The most recent ripple of that point that was proven decades ago by Monty Irvin and the rest of those men, many of them World War II veterans who integrated Major League Baseball, was the decision just a couple of months ago to count statistics from the Negro Leagues as Major League records. Monty Irvin wasn't worried about statistics, even though his helped put him in the Hall of Fame. And when he wrote his autobiography, he took a departure from a quote from his New York Giants manager. Leo Durocher had famously said that nice guys finish last. The title of Monty Irvin's book?
Nice guys finish first.
And what was the point behind that? What did you try to convey with that message?
That you can still be, Leo would do anything to win. I wanted to do the right thing and still win, leave a wonderful legacy, in winning and winning the right way. I wanted to be remembered as someone who came up late, but did the very best I could do under very trying circumstances. I tried to make it better for those who came after me. I tried to show some class wherever I could. And more than anything else, my father told me, he said, "Monty, all you have to do is treat people the way you want to be treated and live by the golden rule, and you'll be okay." So that's the legacy I'd like to leave.
And indeed it is the legacy he left. Monty Irvin passed away in 2016. If you ever have the chance to visit the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, you can think of some of those words you heard when you take a look at his plaque, or maybe even when you see his retired number 20 displayed at a San Francisco Giants game. It is time for our final break, but when we come back, memories from another man who blazed quite a trail during World War II. Maybe blaze isn't the best word to use in this instance, because he would be fighting fires as a smoke jumper with the Triple Nickels. If you've never heard of the Triple Nickels, just wait a few minutes, because you'll hear from one when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, showcasing stories from a few of the nearly 1 million African-American veterans of World War II in honor of Black History Month. Walter Smith was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, when Imperial Japan bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
At that time, I was a teenager, of course, and a football game was on the radio, and I think it was interrupted. The news came over and so forth, and of course, I was excited like everybody else. I hadn't been following the news that closely, and I didn't know that we were ready to go to war. I got with some of my other teenage friends, and we said, well, hey, we want to go. I guess that was our youth talking and so forth, but we wanted to go on our own terms. In the meantime, we heard that the Canadians weren't as segregated as our forces were, and that there was a good chance that we could get into the air branch in the Canadian Air Force. We made a dash up there, but things didn't turn out like we thought, so that was the end of that. I guess we just didn't fit the qualifications. So we came back and waited for the draft. That didn't take very long. We were in segregated outfits, of course, and segregated bases, too. And I remember most of the bases, we had a certain area that we were restricted to. Headquarters was in a what we called white area. And if you wanted to go into headquarters, you had to get permission and so forth. It was just an odd thing. It was hard to get used to. And besides, don't forget, in those days, everything, the water fountains and the things like that, had signs. You only could use the ones designated for colored. When I first went in, I got by training up in Massachusetts. There still was a stigma, because, you know, soldiers always like to go to bars and have a drink and relax and all that sort of thing. But then we found out that some of these bars and so forth didn't want to cater to you. That's where I got in a typical fight. I guess that's where I got my first wound. I got stabbed in a fight when the three or four of us went into a bar. They didn't want to treat us right or serve us appropriately.
Is this a situation where you're in uniform or out of uniform?
Oh, in uniform.
In uniform.
In uniform.
And there's a war going on.
Yeah.
And they know who you're working for.
Oh, yeah. We were all teenagers. I think those guys they hadn't been drafted yet or anything like that, so they were a little older. But they didn't appreciate us coming to their bar. So that was the name of the game, I mean, pretty much everywhere. It wasn't that bad. I mean, so I got stabbed, I bled a little and all that sort of thing. I mean, it was nothing that would put me out of commission or anything.
I can't imagine having that much self-control to put up with some of this stuff and not just go crazy. How did you deal with that ever-present reality without just going ballistic on people?
Well, I think there's always a degree of hope that's involved with the African-Americans in this country. It goes back to the church, too, I think. Lots of us were raised in the church. We believed that things would get better. Really, they did gradually, but it was a slow process. We thought we were going to be fighters. I mean, that was the thing. I guess that's a macho attitude. And you find out that you're using the shovel and the axe and the pick and, you know, all that sort of thing and doing really ground-digging work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and a lot of KP.
Yeah.
Now, you're officers, so your unit is exclusively black, except for the officers,
oh, yeah,
who were predominantly white.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you told me that you can't prove it, but many of you were convinced one of your officers had been in the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. And it wasn't a fact that he tried to hide or anything like that.
What kept you going? What kept you motivated to serve your country when some of your fellow citizens aren't treating you the way that you wanted to be treated?
Because there was always, we always knew that there were people who wanted to help us and do better. I mean, even during slavery time, I mean, the Quakers and so forth and units like that backed us up and helped with the Underground Railroad, as they called it, and so forth. So we knew that there was always hope.
Mm-hmm.
Things would get better. Things were gradually getting better in certain places. So that's the thing that kept us going.
And you decided at some point that you would feel a lot more fulfilled and have a lot more excitement if you got out of that unit that you were in. How did you accomplish that?
Well, at the time, it depended on the president's wife. Mrs. Roosevelt was pushing to have black troops in combat outfits. She succeeded, and that started with some of the outfits like I think it was the 99th. But there were just a few. But at least that was showing that there was hope and everything.
Integration was starting to begin.
Integration was starting. And it was a fight because lots of people objected to it. The word came down that they were going to let blacks be in the paratroopers and so forth. And once you heard about it, I mean, I went into headquarters and wanted to put in my application and so forth. And, of course, it worked out.
So you ended up with the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion.
Yeah.
Otherwise known as the Triple Nickels.
Right.
And you went through the same training at Fort Benning.
Yeah, I went through the same training.
That all the white paratroopers made.
Right.
You hear a lot of times about the 82nd Airborne or the 101st Airborne right. and what they did on D-Day.
Right.
And this is what you thought you would be doing.
Yeah, because we were a part of those units, but we weren't because we were attached, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when they decided that they were going to go across,
So they were heading to Europe to get ready right. for Operation Overlord and this massive invasion in June of 1944. And what happened to you guys? And how frustrating was it that you weren't going with
That's
them?
That's right. It was very frustrating. And then we found out that we would be assigned to the West Coast. That meant that they used us for smoke jumping, firefighting, and so forth.
It must have been an emotional roller coaster for you, because here you're frustrated in the unit you're in. You think you're getting into something a little more exciting and fulfilling with the paratroopers, and then right as everyone's about to ship out, you get sent to the other side of the country, nowhere near where all the fighting's going on.
That's right.
How did you deal with that?
Not too well. I mean, most of us were a little bit discouraged about that, but that was the name of the game, so we played along with it.
One of the things I've read was that the Japanese actually had hydrogen-filled balloons that were unmanned, but equipped with the right mechanisms to know when to release a sandbag to go up higher that could make it all the way to the West Coast and then drop these incendiary bombs in U.S. forests. I had never heard of that before I read up on the smoke jumpers. Now, you don't know how many of the fires you fought were caused by those bombs or not, but tell us a little bit about what these smoke jumps were like, and did you feel like you were in danger as you're dropping out of this airplane to a smoke-filled forest?
Oh, no. I mean, we knew we were near the fires and so forth. I mean, it was just like one of the fires we went to was up in Montana, I think it was. After we jumped there, they took us to the camping area where the firefighters were supposed to congregate and then go to the fire. It was amazing because the town seemed so small that you could look and see from one end of the town to the other. It was just completely different from, I mean, having basically lived on the East Coast, that you had so much space and everything and so many trees and so many fires and all that sort of thing.
And they had to drop you in by parachute just because of how remote these locations
were? Yeah, mostly
were.
Because it was remote. The fire and the smoke, that was our worst enemy. You didn't think about snakes and things like that. Although, I mean, the running animals and so forth, I mean, they did pose a problem, but that was the major problem.
Probably coming from a big city on the East Coast, it was kind of nice to see all of that nature, as you talked about.
Right.
How long did this go on for? Were you doing this until the end of the war? Or?
Yeah, to the end of the war. Then most of us decided to get out. Everybody was leaving the service at that time because, after all, the war was over. And you had a choice. I left the service, the active duty service, and was on the...
You were in the reserves?
In the reserves.
But the GI Bill gave you the money to go to college?
GI Bill, I decided to go to college on that. And there were some of us who did that. That's where I ended up at Hampton University. And, of course, everything worked out from then on.
Well, and that's where you met your wife. So I think someone had that plan for you to end up at Hampton.
I hope so.
And you're convinced that none of this would have happened. And I want to get to this because you made the statement to me that segregation saved your life. The segregated military saved your life. I guess you're convinced that you wouldn't have been there at Hampton to meet your wife or anything since then if the government hadn't sent the white paratroopers over to Europe and sent the black paratroopers to the West Coast. When did you make that realization? And explain that for our listeners, if you can, why you say that segregation saved your life.
Well, we had to have some kind of a joke to cover up the insult and so forth. And, of course, you always do that sort of thing. You put something funny in. That's the way you survive, you know. We said, well, the white paratroopers went over and caught hell on the first... on the initial assault and everything. We weren't there, so we didn't catch hell. So we said that was the point, that probably that segregation saved our lives.
Well, and it, like you say, it is a good laugh line, but there's some pretty solid truth to it, too, because as you mentioned, the casualties, the significant casualties that those paratroopers suffered over there, that easily could have been you if you were there.
That's right.
And you stayed in the reserves, so you know there's a chance of another war. There's a chance Uncle Sam can call you back. And you had a little, I won't say you had a conversation with yourself, but you told yourself something. You made a determination of what you would and wouldn't do. Tell me what that was.
I said I would never fight in a segregated outfit, and that was it.
It just hurt you as a person so much.
Right.
And so here along, just 5 years after World War II, here comes the Korean conflict. You're recalled. What's the Army doing with you?
Well, the transition was taking place, but transition in any force is slow, and our unit had not reached that stage yet. So we had orders to go overseas.
With an artillery unit.
With an artillery unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still going to be segregated. And so I decided, no, I'd promised myself I'd never do that. So I put in for my resignation. And the only way I could do this, having being in the military service, was that I could not go resign with my rank. I have to go into another service. It took a lot of thought, mm-hmm. and it took a lot of soul searching and so forth, because some of the other officers in our black unit, I mean, thought that was ridiculous to give up a lieutenancy.
You were at the time a second lieutenant.
Yeah.
And they told you, if you want to do this, you can go to the Air Force, but you're not a second lieutenant anymore. What? How much rank would you have to give up?
All of it.
All of it.
So I'd go in as an airman.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did.
That's probably a pretty big cut in pay, too, isn't it?
Oh,
go from
yeah.
a second lieutenant to an airman?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But it meant that much to you.
Right.
To not serve in a segregated unit.
Right.
Walter Smith would go on to serve as a navigator on B-29 bombing missions during the Korean War. He remained in the Air Force until 1969, flying with refueling planes during the Vietnam War. He never regretted that decision to give up his rank over the principle that all men are created equal. We've heard just a portion of Mr. Smith's inspiring story today, and of course you can link to that complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.